On the evening of July 27, 1985, a thunderstorm slowly released over Yosemite National Park and lit up the sky more brilliantly than anyone could believe. Those at the bottom sheltered in shocked awe as the sky illuminated with every bolt of lightning, and from their view, they could see figures dancing in the rain on the summit of Half Dome. They had little idea what was coming for them. By the stroke of midnight, two dancers would be dead. The rest of the group would be thrown into debilitating pain and emotional anguish, and one woman would be left to operate the summit like an emergency room. This is their story, and welcome to Tragedy with a View. For this story, I read a book called Shattered Air. The author's name is Bob Magic, but Mad Jick, which I thought is really
interesting.
I've read like multiple books where I'm like, wow, this author has a really cool name, and it also somehow manages to go with the theme of the book. So I thought that was fun. And something that he wrote in the book, which I believe was in 2005, was when it was released. And something that he put in the book that I think is really still applies today is that the science for lightning and lightning strikes is something that we just are starting to understand. We haven't really had the technology until the last couple of decades to really get a grip on what it is and its capabilities. And so some of the information that he was providing was from the time of the events, which was in 1987. He tried to update them as much through 2005 as possible, but he said, you know, things are always changing.
Yeah.
So likewise, I pulled this information from this book that should be up to date through 2005. And I think from what I was able to find, most of the stuff is still like most of the basics is still similar. It's like when you get into the nitty gritty stuff that like things are really changing at this point. And we're not going to go too far into the nitty gritty about lightning because that could be an entire podcast on its own. Mm. So yeah. So then also this episode is going to be a long one. So if you're not comfortable, find a more comfortable space and get some water and some snacks and yeah, it's going to be...
Get comfortable.
Yeah. And I'm also giving a disclaimer that this is a graphic episode, especially as we get into the second half of the story and when the actual lightning strikes and immediate aftercare occur. There's a lot of descriptions that are not easy to listen to, and... So I'm just giving the disclaimer that listening, what do I want to say? Listening discretion is advised.
Listening discretion.
I can't say viewer, like you're not viewing anything.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good description of it.
Yeah. So,
as a side note, I think it's interesting how most of the stories are being written by someone like not the first person.
Yeah.
It's like it's never the person that's going through it that's then writing the books about it.
Well, so I think that's really cool though because you get like an unbiased story. And so I'll just say this because I don't actually include it in the later parts of the episode, but after all of these events happen, one of the people who survived was doing news interviews, and he was giving information like that he was doing certain things, but he was not actually the one doing those. It was somebody else. Mm-hmm. And so there's like that aspect of it too. That's like, he was there and he was living it and he was doing it, but he wasn't giving solely his own information. And of course, like, the news puts out bits and pieces here and there. And so what might have been cut out at the beginning was that he said, like, oh, and so-and-so was doing this and grabbing here, and the news station was just like, okay, we're gonna cut it right when he said grabbing here. And so it was presented that he was talking about himself, but we won't know because we don't have the original stuff. But I do think it's really cool to have like that third party come in and be able to collect everything and be like, all right, these are the events that we know took place, and it just gives a really unbiased story, and I really like those.
Yeah, I just think it's like interesting, and what does that mean that they're not wanting, or they're not incentivized to tell it themselves? You know, it's always someone else coming in.
Yeah,
I don't know. We don't have an answer for it, I don't think, but it's just a curious observation I had.
Yeah, there might be like a traumatic.
Maybe. Yeah.
Like, it might just be too much for them to like relive it in a way.
Yeah.
Or
some kind of, you know, not wanting to take ownership of the experience, especially if they're, it'd be different if they were alone, but if it's in a group like this story.
Yeah.
Well, I don't want to be the one to speak for everybody.
Yeah.
Whereas like a third party, it's like, well, they're not, they're just collating other stories into one.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, that's an interesting observation. All right, so we are going to start talking about Yosemite first, because Yosemite actually has a really cool background. And have you been to Yosemite?
I haven't.
It's right now like on the top of my list, mostly because I've been working on this particular episode for like what feels like 6 months. I don't think it's been 6 months, but it was like I started reading the book in like end of December, early January. So like I've been in it for a while, and so then I started looking at pictures and I was like, wow, this place is gorgeous. And now it's like, maybe we should revisit our vacations this year and maybe go to California instead. We're not going to, we've already got stuff booked. But Yosemite has a violent past. Like, This area was not treated nicely when the natives were getting pushed out and white men were coming in. And it's theorized that when the white men moved into the area, they saw these natives as dangerous as grizzlies. So in 1851, Native Americans were permanently driven from their homes within Yosemite by the Mariposa Battalion, who entered, captured, and killed any natives that didn't run fast enough.
Okay.
So there's the We Are the Killers name. And I don't...
I wonder if that came before or after.
I was just going to say, I don't know exactly when that was determined, but I think there's a link there. The battalion that drove the natives from this land would then go on to name the very large landmarks within Yosemite, including El Capitan, Little Yosemite, Vernal Falls, and Nevada Falls, which are all like pretty major landmarks within the park. Yosemite was named a national park in 1890, making it the United States' third national park, though it was a protected area for 26 years prior to its national park designation. And this this seems kind of surprising to me. The park was designated, like, it has designated wilderness area, which means that you cannot do any sort of industrialized logging, mining, or even putting in roads or using motored vehicles. 95% of Yosemite is this designated wilderness area. And so some of the park rangers, to get from one place to another with a little bit more ease, will go on horseback.
Nice.
Which is a lot of fun.
Yeah.
For a horse lover like me, that's a lot of fun. So originally, national parks were used and treated as attractions, which meant that Yosemite at one point had a ski area, gas stations, motels, houses, stores, a golf course, swimming pool, and tennis courts. All of which have been removed.
In the 5% of the area?
No. So that it's now 95%.
Now okay.
So I could have explained that better. That's when okay. I was saying it. Yeah. So lakes that naturally had no fish in them were stocked with trout, and there was a bonfire each night at Glacier Point, where to conclude the bonfire, the hot ashes, while they were still glowing red, were dumped over the side of one of the cliffs to create a firefall.
Hmm.
Which sounds very, very much like a fire hazard to me.
Yeah.
That sounds like...
Sounds like a bad TikTok trend.
It is a bad TikTok trend. Yeah. It was just the early 1900s version of it, I guess. Yeah. So by the 70s, a major shift was occurring in national parks, and the National Park Service was promoting the enjoyment of nature in her truest form. To outline what they mean by this, national parks, they preserve the life and death of animals. They support the natural building and destruction of beloved monuments, and support quiet enjoyment of nature that are all built and balanced by each other. Humans interfere far too often, and in 1980, a general management plan was enacted to reclaim the natural beauty of the park, allowing natural processes to prevail and promoting visitor understanding and enjoyment to help reduce the traffic and ease crowding. So I think that's when it shifted from like golf course, swimming pool, tennis courts to like remove all that and let nature take over.
Yeah. I wonder if that was Teddy Roosevelt. I don't know the timeline as well.
Might have been.
Yeah.
It might have been. So in short, when this shift started happening, park officials were basically like, you're in the wrong place, get out, and started letting nature do what nature does, which is both beautiful and tragic, and that needs to stay that way. I know a lot of people want to fight against the tragic side of it, but
then we wouldn't have a podcast.
And then we want to have a podcast. Well, so there's like, I think it was last summer, there was a guy who like saved a baby bison from drowning, and in Yellowstone, I'm pretty sure it was Yellowstone, and he was like arrested for it, and like people were throwing fits, and like a lot of people were like, he's just trying to save it. And then everyone else was just like, not quite understanding what the big deal is. And the parks, and I tried to go back and find their comment about it, but they basically explained like, we do not interfere. We just do not interfere. It's a natural process. The life and death of these animals brings new life and death of this entire ecosystem. And if we just tried to prevent all of the animals from dying, the ecosystem would collapse. And I mean, they put it way better than me, and I tried to find it, but I couldn't. Yeah. So,
well, and it's a hard delineation because like it starts with you saving a baby bison from drowning, but then like, where does the line get drawn?
Right.
Cause then it's like, well, but then, you know, I want to protect the herd from you know, running off the cliff. And it's like, okay, yeah, all good intentions, but what are the consequences?
Right.
And humans have shown time and time again that we don't accommodate and anticipate well in terms of like the consequences of nature.
Yeah. No.
So.
No, we don't. And we're going to talk about one of those situations here. So inside of Yosemite is Half Dome, which is one of the most popular and notorious places. The native legend is that a woman named Tissiak walked into the valley and was so thirsty from her travels that she knelt to drink from the lake and drank all of the water down. Behind her, her husband Nangas approached, and he was also extremely thirsty. And when he saw that she had drank all of the water, he got angry and began to beat her. And in her defense, she threw the basket she had been carrying with her at him. Because their actions were violent and sinful and wrong, they were then turned to stone. So Tissiak became Half Dome, and Nangas became the Washington Column. The face of Half Dome has dark streaks on it, and they say that these are from her tears. And I think the face too, that if you like catch it at like the right time of day where like the sun hits it just right, it almost looks like there's a face on the face of the cliff as well. Of course, there have been many theories over the centuries about how Half Dome was created. Do you know what Half Dome looks like?
No, I can look it up.
Yeah.
Oh.
So it looks like half.
Half of a dome?
Yeah, half. It looks like half of a mountain. So, of course, there have been many theories over the centuries about how Half Dome was created, including that it was once a whole mountain that split in half and that glaciers forced the sheer wall to be formed from pressure as Half Dome climbed towards the sky. But the truth is that the straight wall was created by a process called erosion and exfoliation. So what happens is it once had more of a curve, but not quite as drastic as the other side. And as the rain came down, it would catch in like the gullies and the little cracks in the like more sheer side. And then it would freeze and cause those cracks to get larger. And then it would just shear off a little bit at a time. Half Dome overlooks Yosemite Valley, which is roughly half a mile wide to 1 mile wide and about 7 miles long. The first documented time that Half Dome was summited was on October 12th of 1875 by George Anderson, and he did this after multiple other attempts by drilling holes into the curved side of Half Dome, and he would insert iron rods into the holes. And so he was putting them roughly like as far as he could reach. So he was standing on one of the rods, and then he would reach up, drill the hole, and put the new rod in and climb his way up there. So these rods are 5 to 6 feet apart, and he essentially made steps to climb up Half Dome. It took him multiple days, but in the end, he was successful, and this helped make the trip easier the next time that he came up. He ended up using a rope to tie to each of the rods, so that way he could just simply like pull himself up the cable system that he installed to reach the summit. George Anderson hadn't realized that this method would still be used today. Many replacements have been made to both the rods and the rope and the holes, but today you will see two lengths of steel cable. They're a few feet apart, running up the curved side of Half Dome, and the pegs anchored into the rocks have planks of wood between them to act as like little steps. Since the cables were installed, 9 people have fallen to their deaths, which the most recent one was in 2019.
Okay, so these rods are original?
No, they have been replaced.
Okay. Because this seems, I'm looking at pictures, this is very crude. It also is very vertical.
Yes.
And I'm seeing like kids do this. This seems real sketchy. And maybe it's just the Google images, but wow. That's a tough tumble too. Oh yes. My gosh.
So I think in part to try to make the system safer, you now need a permit in order to climb Half Dome. And it's like a lottery system. So you have to sign up like ahead of time, and you might get it, you might not. Apparently they're pretty, like the permits are very highly sought after. Mm-hmm. So there's a chance that you're going to get a permit, and then there's also chances that you're not going to. And from what I understand, it was to try to ease the number of people who are going up and down the cables in a single day, partially because that's a lot of wear and tear on the safety device, but also when you're going up and down, you have to move around all of those people that are going the opposite direction.
Yeah.
And that's probably the least safe part, is like shifting around someone. So then apparently you can also get like a harness that you can clip to the cables.
Okay.
But you're still going to have to unclip it to go around each of those pegs. Like, yeah. It's not a continuous thing.
Oof.
I think, relatively speaking, for the number of people that climb Half Dome, 9 is a very small number.
Yeah, percentages are...
yeah, the percentage is very, very small. Those 9 lives are very, very important. But it's a small... relatively speaking, they're safe.
Dude, look at that. It does look like it was split in half.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So current day, you need to have a permit to be able to climb Half Dome. And while this story was taking place, they were planning to sleep at the summit of Half Dome, which you can no longer do, partially because, and we're going to talk a little bit very, very briefly about this particular location, but there were so many people camping on the summit that they had like a designated bathroom area where people were just defecating on the summit. And this started affecting the life that was on the summit of Half Dome, and park officials started seeing it affect the salamanders that were living there.
Oh.
And it was really impacting like that population, and they were like, this has to stop. You cannot camp on Half Dome anymore.
Yeah.
And I didn't write it down, but I believe that was like somewhere in the early 1990s that they stopped allowing you to sleep on Half Dome. So nobody get any ideas.
It seems like it. I mean, I'll be honest, looking at those pictures, it doesn't seem like that would be a fun evening. I mean, the views for a sunset might be nice, but like that's going to be cold, windy. I mean, it's all rock.
It is all rock.
I don't know.
You're all in the open. And not to mention, the trek alone to get to the base of Half Dome is considered moderate to difficult. So the there's a couple different trails that you can take to get there. The shorter one is 8 miles.
Whoa. Okay.
So
that's a long hike.
Yeah. You've got a lot of miles to go before you get there. And then there's also the elevation change that you have to accommodate for. And it's not an easy thing to do. It's completely doable, but it's not just like, I mean, Angel's Landing is like a 2 or 2.5 mile trip up to the top, and then you're like there, you're good to go, and you can go back down and you're done within like a 5 mile time. Like, this is a little bit different than that.
Yeah,
it's quite a bit different than that.
Yeah.
So Half Dome sits between two canyons, which is Yosemite Valley and the Tenaya Canyon, and it has an elevation of 8,892 feet or 7,210 meters. And this means that the summit rises a mile into the air and the sheer face overlooks Yosemite Valley. Hmm. The layout of these canyons helps storms that develop near them just kind of funnel towards Half Dome. One of the trails, there's like some like really notorious steps that take you to Subdome. One of the trails skips those steps, and I didn't really look up like the actual information of these steps, but it's like one of those things where it's like annoying and you keep going up these steps and you're like, why am I doing this? I'm not even to Half Dome yet, and they're just annoying. Hmm. The other trail skips those steps, but it's a mile and a half longer. So you're going like almost 10 miles if you take that route. And then it doesn't actually like skip the elevation change. You're just going up a more, or I guess a less drastic elevation change than by using the steps. At the base of Subdome, it does not matter what route you take, you are going to come across a metal sign that reads in both English and Spanish, "Danger. If a thunderstorm is anywhere on the horizon, do not pass beyond this sign. Lightning has struck Half Dome during every month of the year." And then on top of that, when you get to the summit, there is a second sign that reads, "Danger. If a thunderstorm occurs while you are here, these are the safest things to do. 1, step away from the cables. 2, get rid of any metallic objects. 3, stay away from caves, overhangs, and large cracks in the rocks. 4, go to the lowest place on the top and sit on any non-metallic objects you have to insulate you from the rocks. Wait and stay there until the storm has passed."
Oh, boy.
So this is setting up for some failure in observation. And I don't necessarily think that it's a failure in observation, just a failure in understanding.
Yeah.
So
the fact that you have to stay away from like edges and crevices is really scary. Also, you have to ride out the storm on the top of it. Oh my God.
Yeah. So in a completely unrelated book, it was a book about a bear attack of all things, the very like opening. So I read this Shattered Air. Next book I got into was a book about a bear attack. And like the very first chapter was like, these guys were in the Canadian wilderness and a thunderstorm rolled in, and they all had to like, he basically outlined like what you're supposed to do when a lightning storm moves in. And it's basically like, you need to get like at least 30 feet away from other people and tall objects. So you're basically out in the open. You can't, like, having like shelter above you is not a smart thing to do. If you have like anything metal in your pack or like a metal framed pack, gotta take that off and chuck it. And then the best thing to do if you don't have anything to like stand on to insulate you from the ground is to crouch down. So you're balancing on the balls of your feet and then touch your heels together. The theory being that if lightning strikes the ground or like somehow moves to the ground and underneath you, the current will potentially go up 1 foot and then follow your heels and go back out the other rather than going all the way up into your body. Mm. So I just thought that was a really interesting
intro. Well, and, you know, we're bags of salt water. So it's like, yes, we're not, in and of ourselves, we're not protected. So it's like we're already vulnerable, let alone, you know, having any type of metal or, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then like some lightning comes ground up.
So we're going to talk about that.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about that.
That's so interesting. Heals together. So it's like a little route, a smaller route, yeah, potentially.
Potentially.
Ugh.
Yeah. So in this story, we have four groups of people that we are going to talk about because they all kind of play a role. There's multiple people with the same name. So some of the people I'm referring to by their last name, some of the people I'm referring to by their first name. But there's really like two groups that we're going to be focusing on, and you're going to see that because their names just keep getting repeated. So the first group is made up of Adrian Esteban, Tom Rice, Bill Pippi, Carl Buckner, Bob Frith, Bruce Weiner, and Steve Elner, and then twin brothers Brian and Bruce Jordan. Tom Rice has a bit of a wild streak, and him and Esteban had been friends for years, and they kind of had a initiation process to anyone who wanted to climb Half Dome with them. And so this particular story, they don't have everyone do this thing, but individually, they would leap into a small pool of water called Paradise. The ledge that they were leaping from was 44 feet above the pool of water. So I want to say there was like a waterfall somewhere along the route. It wasn't Vernal or Nevada Falls, but there was this waterfall. They would climb out onto the edge and jump into the pool of water. The pool of water was 15 feet deep, which is plenty of room to accommodate the jump. However, this height is taller than like a competition high dive height. Mm-hmm. And if you enter the water wrong at that height, you can break bones.
Mm.
So the fact that multiple of these people had completed this jump without any incidences happening kind of already tells you like how, I guess, lucky they are. And also that they've done this particular hike multiple times. They know Yosemite. They know Half Dome. Like, this is not an odd or like one-off experience for them. So
what is the age range? Do we know?
Yes. So all of the men in this group were in their mid to late 20s, with Rice being 28 and Esteban being 24. Everyone else was kind of in between there, except for the twins, Brian and Bruce Jordan, who were 16. So Pippi brought the twins with him. So I think there were like three or four people who were not part of this group. They were just attending for the day. And the twin boys were kind of starting down a rough path with drug use and kind of wanting to drop out of school and like not a good, healthy place to be. And at some point when Pippi was around their age, he was going down the same path. And it was the Jordan twins' parents who kind of got him on the right track. And I don't remember exactly how they knew each other, but he felt like they were family. Mm-hmm. So when Pippi started noticing that these guys were going down this path, he was like, hey, I have this really cool experience. It changed my life. Come do this thing with me. And so he brought the twins with him. The second group we're going to talk about is actually just two rock climbers who were climbing up the face of Half Dome. Their names are Rob Foster and Ken Boakland. They were 18 and 19 years old. And I'm also really impressed by like the number of like teens and young 20s peoples who are out here doing stuff like this. Like,
I mean, you almost have to be, because once you hit 35, it's like your mortality is more prominent.
Yeah.
Yeah. When you're young, it's like, nah.
Yeah. Go do all these awesome things. I think it's cool. I'm all for it. So then we have the third group, which includes Mike Hoag, Dan Crozier, Linda Crozier, Rick Pedroncelli, and Jeannie Hayes. And this group is slightly younger, with the like in the early to mid 20s range. Linda and Mike, we're going to talk about more. So Linda is 22 and Mike is 21. And then we have the final group, which is Brian Cage, Clue Cotter, Zip Cotter, Steve White, Paul Kobenschlag, and Monroe Bridges. On Thursday, July 25th, 1985, Ken and Rob were on the bottom of Half Dome looking up the wall, preparing for their three-day ascent up the face. Neither boy had a ton of money, so they decided to bring only what they truly needed, including rain gear, pants, an extra shirt, a sleeping pad, all packed inside of canvas sacks. So neither brought a sleeping bag because they thought that it would be too bulky, and with between the two of them, they only had one pair of gloves.
Okay.
So they're 18 and 19. They're out there living their lives.
Did they plan on like camping at the top with just a sleeping mat?
So they were climbing up the face. So they were like doing like the legitimate rock climbing.
Yeah.
And they were going to spend two nights on the face. And then once they got to the top, they were planning to just hike out from there. So okay. I think theirs is a little bit more understandable because they weren't going to be sleeping on flat ground. They were basically just going to tie in and stay there.
Okay.
So they also had, along with all of their ropes and climbing gear, they had food, and their bags weighed 30 pounds, and they also brought about 40 pounds of water with them. So ooh, they were fully planning on this taking 3 days.
Yeah.
On that Thursday, they started the climb at sunrise, and the first day on the wall was fairly uneventful. On Friday, the 26th, Ken and Rob were making their way past the halfway point on the northwest face of Half Dome. They knew that the weather had been a little bit unpredictable in the days prior, but they saw a window of like decent weather, and they were like, we got to take it now. Climbing Half Dome is not exactly an easy task. The wall sits at an 88 degree angle, so it's pretty much straight up and down. Along with this, there is an extremely smooth section located about halfway up the wall that is 100 feet high, and it has nearly no hand or footholds. So the way that you get around the smooth section, they about 30 feet up, they have a piston installed in the wall that they're able to rope into, and then they lower themselves back down and start to run back and forth along the wall to basically make a pendulum swing. And eventually you get up enough momentum that they can get up towards the top of that 100 foot smooth section and grab a hold of a very small ledge that is there.
Oh my.
Then there is a second kind of tricky part called the visor, which is an overhang at the top. And there is also a small ledge there that it's sketchy but walkable. That's the way that it's described. I'm going to let that be whatever
Yeah.
Whatever so like it a means.
2-inch ledge.
I can get my pinky toe here.
Jeez.
So the ledge has been named Thank God Ledge. And if you work your way along the ledge towards the end, there's better handed footholds to climb up and essentially over the overhang. So you go under and then over the overhang. The climb typically takes about 2 days. And so the boys had brought their gear with that intention, and they knew that there was the potential that they would get rained on. So they also had rain pants and jackets and helmets, which I think is smart.
Okay.
On that Friday afternoon, a storm rolled in, and Ken and Rob took shelter in a formation called a chimney, which is basically like an insert into the rocks that's like, and when I say an insert, I don't mean it's like, oh, there's this like hole in the wall. It's like a divot that you can kind of like squeeze yourself into. So they found this chimney, and they had three sides on them, and then the fourth side was open, and they wedged themselves in and had their feet against one side and their backs against the other and just kind of like hung out there. They started seeing flashes of lightning and noticed that the water that was coming from the rain on the summit and coming down was filtering through this chimney that they were in. They started seeing the flashes of lightning, and then they felt one as it hit the summit, and the current was carried down by the water and electrocuted them, essentially. Oh. So for several minutes at the worst of the storm, the lightning struck Half Dome again and again, and the electrical currents were carried down to the boys, and they were getting small jolts every time this happened. So not enough that they were like losing what grip they had inside of this chimney, but Rob describes that each of these strikes felt as if his tongue was being driven out of his mouth. And while they were not high enough to injure either of the boys, they were getting zapped. So like, you know how like you get like the static electricity going and you touch metal and it like zings you?
Yeah.
It's like really strong versions of those.
Yeah.
So.
And if it's enough, if it just like keeps happening, you know, they're. What is that doing to your CNS system?
Yeah.
You know, it's like, it's not doing damage in and of itself, but the accumulation is like, okay.
Yeah.
What's the effect of this?
Yeah. Which is not something that they really studied at in the year 1987.
Right.
So they never considered rappelling down to escape the storm and the threat of lightning strikes, because they knew that the majority of fatalities in climbing are a result from descending. And in climbing specifically, a lot of people who are trying to get out of a situation, they rappel too quickly and end up just going right off the end of their rope. So while all of this is happening, the group of nine, including Rice, Esteban, Frith, Weiner, and the Jordan twins, met up at a campground around midnight. And going into Saturday, the 27th, Elner and Buckner had decided to like kind of hang back, and they were going to go the longer of the two routes towards Half Dome. Even though this like group of nine was now split up into a group of seven and a group of two, they were all still planning to meet at the summit of Half Dome to stay the night on that Saturday night. At the same time, Hoag and Crozier's and their group were meeting up in Yosemite Valley, and at around 4 a.m. on Saturday morning, Brian Cage and his group woke up in their homes in San Jose and drove through the rest of the night to get to Glacier Point, which is the start of the 9.5 mile trail. So there's Brian Cage's group and Elner and Buckner, who are going the 9.5 mile route. Hoag's group, the group of seven, going the 8 mile route. The morning of Saturday, the 27th, Mike, Linda, Dan, Rick, and Jenny were all up by 6:30, and they downed their breakfast and started their hike to Half Dome via the Mist Trail, which is the 8 mile route. And similarly, Rice, Esteban, and their group basically woke up ready to go, and they downed their breakfast, but they were in a different camping area. And so while they were also taking Mist Trail, they first had to hike through the valley to get to the trailhead. So they were starting a little bit more behind. However, their group was very athletic and very competitive, not only with themselves, but with each other. And so as they're like hiking down the trail, they're constantly switching like who's first. They're like the crazy people that you're like, okay, these guys, we're going to get out of their way because they clearly are not stopping for anything. So around noon, Hoag's group arrived at Nevada Falls, which is another kind of location where a bunch of trails kind of converge together. So they decided to stop and eat lunch here. Around a half hour later, Rice, Esteban, Pippi, and the twins arrived, and then a few minutes later, Frith and Weiner followed. Buckner and Elner, because they were taking a alternate route, were not coming through like the same area at the same time. They also were not quite as athletic as this other group, so they were like stopping a lot. They were taking their time. I think they had one backpack that they were switching on and off, so that way neither of them had to carry the full load the whole time. And then once the groups had congregated here at Nevada Falls, Rice, Pippi, and a couple of the others decided that they were going to go skinny dipping, and they stripped down and jumped into the water and swam out to this little like rocky island. It's not really an island, but it's like a little bit of rock that's sticking up out of the water. And they like went there and they were dancing on the rocks and they were like clearly having a good time. But Linda and Jenny, who were in with Hoag's group, they saw them doing this and they were like, this is really inappropriate. There's families here. There's children here. What are you people doing? And they were really put off by this. And they were like, okay, let's go. We don't want to be anywhere near these guys. So they got up and packed out about 1:30 in the afternoon. And it was about this time that thick clouds started rolling in. And they started thinking that they were going to get some rain. We're actually going to segue a little bit and talk about lightning and storms. Thunderstorms have a huge potential of power. I think most of us know that, especially those of us who live in a place that gets tornadoes. Like, there is a lot of potential within thunderstorms. And one of the most deadly aspects to thunderstorms is lightning. Lightning is extremely chaotic and it can sometimes form out of nowhere. And cloud-to-ground lightning can strike an object that is potentially right below it or miles away. In the Sierra Nevadas, specifically, storms, even the ones that form inland, are pulling moisture from the Pacific Ocean, which means that these clouds are really thick and really full with moisture. So as they are moving inland and towards the mountain range, the warmer air that's near the ground forces the clouds to rise higher into the atmosphere. And these clouds will then begin to clash with the colder air, which cools the moisture. And within the cloud, all of that moisture and water droplets turn to either snow or ice. It is these snow and ice crystals, as the storm and clouds are all moving around, that collide with each other, and these begin to produce the amount of friction needed to form static electricity that is needed for lightning. Within the cloud, there are aggressive drafts that push the air around and basically add to the friction, and they generate their own energy for the lightning. There are three stages to thunderstorms: developing, mature, and dissipating. The developing stage is actually the most dangerous, because that's when all of the energy is forming and that energy needs to be released. Additionally to this, a lot of people don't take approaching storms into like consideration, that it could potentially be a deadly moment, because to them the storm has not arrived yet. But because of how lightning works, lightning can strike 10 miles away, which means the storm can still be 10 miles away and it can strike where you are standing. As the static within a cloud forms and becomes stronger, the charges within the clouds will split. And this isn't always how it happens, but generally speaking, the positive ions travel to the top of the cloud and the negative go to the bottom. The ground is also positively charged, which is why you get, or I guess how you get the different lightnings, where it can go cloud to ground or it can stay all within the cloud, because it could potentially be going up towards the positive ions in the top of the cloud. There are different forms of lightning, which are basically determined by where they originate and where they connect to. Invisible to the human eye, there's positively charged feelers reaching up from the ground, and these are called a discharge. And at the same time, negatively charged feelers called leaders are coming down from the cloud. So as those feelers are reaching down towards each other, it's the connection when two of those meet that forms the cloud to ground lightning. So, one, you don't know where those feelers are. The only way that you could possibly know where those feelers are is if you're standing in the mountains or outdoors somewhere and your hair is standing on end. You are a feeler. You are a potential streak. So that's like really the only indication that you could possibly have, is that energy. The static causes your hair to do the thing with the balloon.
Yeah.
So because of this, and because you never really know like where the energy is coming from and what areas are producing more energy and potentially the feelers are going higher, that's part of the reason why lightning can strike 10 miles away, is because you might have a feeler that's like way yonder that's shooting all the way up into the sky, and like one of those very first feelers on the edge of the storm just happens to meet it and they make that connection.
Hmm.
That also pulls me back to the comment you made earlier about coming from the ground and going up towards the cloud. That's actually just those two feelers coming together, and for whatever reason, that the way the human brain understands the light is that it's going backwards.
Okay.
So it's not actually coming from, I mean, it is coming from the ground. All cloud to ground lightning is also coming from the ground as much as it's coming from the cloud.
Hmm.
So connection, of course, is very dramatic. You get lightning out of it. You also get thunder. So you can't have thunder without lightning. which means that if you're outside and you hear thunder, you are potentially at risk for being struck by lightning.
Yeah. I think thunder is almost the cooler aspect. Like, I love storms. And it's, while the lightning is visually appealing and it's kind of like fun to see, I think the impact of the thunder is higher because it's so visceral.
Mm-hmm.
It's so loud. You can sometimes feel it and you're like, I can't believe that there is a force like this great.
Yeah.
It's just here.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think the thunder aspect of storms is pretty wild.
I like thunder. I really like storms, but I've started to get a little bit of anxiety with them because my child's scared of storms. Mm-hmm. Pro tip for all of the boy moms out there, or girl moms that also have boyish tendencies. Last year, I told my son that thunder was just the sky farting. And for a season, he wasn't scared of storms. He thought it was funny. So, but that, of course, didn't last. So he's scared of storms and he's scared of thunder. And so now, like, if there's a storm coming in or it wakes me up at night, I'll just, like, lay there and be like, all right, when's he going to wake up? When do I need to get him in bed with me? I'm going to have to calm him down and I'm going to have to pull out every trick in the book. Like, and I've started getting anxiety with storms because of his fear. And so I am really look forward to the day where he's old enough that I can be like, handle it yourself. And I'm going to
get back to appreciating.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's probably going to be some work, though, to like reverse those tendencies.
I think every like computer desktop background I've had is a lightning storm.
Yeah.
It's like, it's always the first thing I put on there.
Yeah.
It's the best.
Yeah. They're really cool and they're really beautiful too.
Yeah.
Like
stunning.
As long as you stay out of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So because light travels faster than sound, thunder is a good way to determine how far away the storm and lightning is. So it takes the sound of thunder roughly 5 seconds to travel a mile, meaning if you count the seconds between the flash and the crack, that can tell you whether you're like in the quote unquote danger zone. However, 10 miles would be roughly 50 seconds, which is is a long time to count, but also that starts to get on the edge of where like human ears can hear the thunder. So if you hear thunder, you're in striking distance. We'll just simplify it. And I'm also not like sitting here trying to like scare anyone. Like lightning, I think lightning strikes in some variety is relatively common. Like there's a lot of people who have been indirectly affected by lightning or indirectly struck by lightning and have no problems. There's just a lot of unknowns and you can't predict how or when or what the effects will be of being struck by lightning. And so like we're gonna kind of talk a little bit about the actual strength of lightning, but I don't want anyone to like sit there and be like, I need to stay inside whenever there's a thunderstorm, because the percentages are still small. Like they're not none. They're not even like 10%, but they're you judge your own risk.
I think there's some like common sense mitigation measures.
Yeah.
As well that
yeah.
I think most people are probably subconsciously doing but this situation is very different. They're very exposed.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, common person's probably got rubber-soled shoes on. They're insulated. It's like, yeah. It's just, you're not as vulnerable.
These guys.
Most of the time.
Yeah, these guys, and I really hate to say it, but these guys pretty much do all the wrong things.
Yeah.
And it's really unfortunate, but I really also like how the people came together. So we're telling the story.
Yeah.
Lightning is a ginormous source of energy, producing up to 100 million volts of electricity, a temperature of 55,000 degrees, and a flash as bright as 10 million 100 watt light bulbs. They have been shown to be able to create in that one single strike the same amount of energy as all of the power plants in the United States in that same moment.
I mean, that's so crazy.
It's so much.
It's so much. But then also, if you think about it, it makes sense. Like, if you have a mile long lightning bolt, like, it's the power of that entire real estate of, I mean, what, electrons?
Yeah.
So, and it's like you're harnessing, like, the atmosphere. So it's going to be that, but the numbers, like, putting that into perspective is, like, the temperature alone is, what?
Yeah. Yeah. And so the... some signs to pay attention to if you do find yourself outdoors and are worried about your risk. The signs that those feelers are coming up around you or like in your direct vicinity include the air will snap or sizzle. I immediately thought of when I'm running on country roads and there's electrical lines there, you can hear the buzzing of the electricity going through those lines. So I would guess it's either like that sound, if anyone listening is familiar with that sound, or maybe even louder than what's there. If you're not familiar with that sound, I'm sorry, go find a country road and sit there in silence for a minute. So then there's also, as I mentioned before, when your hair's standing on end, that's another big indicator. Lightning can strike a person in one of four ways. The first is by directly hitting them, following the ground, and then entering the person's body from the ground. By directly hitting something that the person is touching. And kind of opposite to striking an object that a person is touching, it's by striking a person and then kind of like skimming along the outside of their body. And sometimes also inside of their body. And then like if you are touching that person, it can potentially go to you too.
Well, and that's some of the danger is it's the exiting.
Yes.
Of the salt bag.
Yes.
Which is our body.
Yes.
Yeah.
So lightning, one of the reasons why caves are so dangerous is because the water and the rocks are all conducting that electricity and it doesn't give it anything to ground to. And so it can like bounce around inside of a cave. Lightning, when directly striking a person, is clearly the most devastating, but this doesn't mean that the other avenues have a lesser impact. But this also doesn't mean that a direct hit has a deadly impact. While the effects of lightning are absolutely, absolutely deadly, the odds of being killed by lightning are low of those who have been struck. So we're not talking about like entire population. It's like not your risk of being struck. It's of those who have been struck. 90% survive. So even when lightning enters the body, if it doesn't cross your heart or neurovascular systems, the chances of survival are high. And this is partially because of how fast lightning is. It just zings in and out, and you don't realize what's happened until it's well over. And there's people out there who have been like, I might have been struck by lightning, but I cannot confirm that because it was just so fast.
Yeah.
So of course, cardiac arrest is a potential when you're struck by lightning, especially if it hits your heart or goes around your heart. And then there's also burns that are a high probability, but there's also the potential to endure mental disorders, insomnia, depression, memory loss, mood changes, migraines, anxiety, nerve damage, blindness, brain damage, and seizures if you are struck by lightning. And these are just the lasting effects, not the ones that like you need to deal with immediately, like muscular damage and tissue damage. And another big one is shock. I think I listed that in that, but shock can be deadly if it's not treated.
Yeah. I mean, they could just say really anything's possible. It's a really extensive list.
Really anything is possible. So lightning that travels within the body can zap the moisture and water required for the body to function, and then sear off the capacity of the muscles, joints, tendons, and veins to be able to distribute that water to the nearby organs and muscles. This makes lightning one of the most difficult to assess and treat of natural phenomenons. Hmm. So back to the story. When someone expressed their concern to Rice and Esteban, Rice told them that the summit had caves that they would be able to take shelter in and stay dry. So he basically was like, we're going to climb up to the summit, whether it's raining or not. Like, we'll be able to stay dry. And who cares if we get a little wet, which is very much his attitude.
Okay.
So they then started gathering up and working to get back to the summit of Half Dome when Brian Cage's group arrived to Nevada Falls. And Cage's group pretty much did the same thing. They stripped down and went out to the rock, and they were also having a good time. But no one else kind of hung around very long. So like as people were starting to make their way towards Half Dome, like there was like less and less gaps between the parties. It wasn't until around 2 p.m. though that Buckner and Elner arrived to Nevada Falls. And by this time, all of the other groups had already moved on. And down the trail a ways, Pippi and Bruce Jordan separated from Esteban Rice and Brian Jordan, and they ended up hopping past Hoag's group as well. So they were like way far ahead. So they had Hoag's group, and then right behind them was Esteban Rice and Brian Jordan. And so Pippi and Bruce Jordan were the first ones to reach the cables. And they were like super excited. Let's go. Started charging up the cables. And about 100 feet up, Pippi suddenly felt like he had knots in his stomach, and his stomach began to bloat. And of this, he later says, and this is a quote, "One minute I'm fine, the next I can barely keep my bowels from exploding." So there's not really like an explanation as to like maybe he ate bad food, or maybe we don't know why he had this, or it might have just been divine intervention.
Wait, we still don't know why he was getting bloated immediately? Yeah,
he basically was like, I need to use the bathroom right now.
Oh.
Which is like, a weird, like, unless it's something that, like, you know, you eat something weird, or like you eat something that's bad, or you're sick, like, that's not a normal experience.
There's some, like, warning signs.
Yeah. So he pretty much either didn't, or he ignored any other sign that was going on here. So they were about 100 feet up the cables, which is about a quarter of the way. And he was like, nope, we got to turn around. We got to go down right now. So those two retreated down the cables and disappeared into the woods, so that way Pippi could take care of whatever was going on with his stomach. So about 4 p.m., Ken and Rob, the two rock climbers, made it to the summit of Half Dome, and because of their experience with the storm the day before and that they could see dark clouds moving in again, they were like, we need to get off of here now.
Yeah. The chimney electrocution was enough.
They had it.
Yeah.
They'd had enough. They descended the cable so fast that they got rope burns on their hands. And once they reached Subdome, they just started running.
Oh, wow.
I think they were frightened.
Huh.
So.
And there was no interaction? Like, why are you guys running, you know?
So once they got off of Subdome, they ran into Esteban and Rice, and in passing, they mentioned that they shouldn't go up there and wait out the storm. It was too dangerous. And at this point, neither Esteban or Rice really thought much of this warning. They heard this and they thought of the danger as more of a challenge and that they could handle it together. And at this point, Brian Jordan had fallen, like, way back. So Esteban and Rice, who have a history of climbing Half Dome together, just got more excited with the potential of danger, and they didn't have anyone else around them to be like, to kind of ground them a little bit and, like, bring them down.
So the one twin is just left behind.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. The one 16-year-old who has no idea what's going on.
Okay.
So it's worth noting, however, Esteban had some, like, premonition feelings the first time that he climbed Half Dome. He felt like he was going to know somebody who fell from Half Dome. So he, throughout his visits, kind of always had this thought in the back of his mind that, like, I'm going to know someone who's fallen off of Half Dome. And at this point, he didn't really pay a whole lot of attention to that thought anymore. He had made it to the summit multiple times, never had a bad experience. But with the excitement of climbing and the storm and the danger, he completely forgot all about this. On July 27th, lightning was one of the few things on the minds of those that were making their way towards Half Dome. At some point, Hoag's group gets ahead of Esteban and Rice. However, when they reached the camping area that was just below Subdome, they talked to someone who was coming down the stairs, and he was described as an older hiker, and he basically was like, hey, there's a storm coming. I wouldn't go up there if I were you. And they kind of congregated there and were like, they all agreed, like, yeah, you know what, we're gonna wait out the storm. We'll just get our camping gear out here. We'll sit down, we'll eat some food, we'll relax, and then see where the night takes us. As Hoag's group then turned around and was kind of working their way back to a safe place to wait out the storm, Esteban and Rice passed them. Dan Crozier mentioned to them what the older hiker had told them, and Rice and Esteban were both, like, eating it up. They were like, yeah, we know.
Dude.
We're going.
These two.
So around 5:40 p.m., Esteban and Rice arrived at the cables for Half Dome. They paused to take in their surroundings, made mention that it seemed like the rain wasn't too far off, and then without a second thought, charged up the cables. As they went on their way, and I think this is kind of at least something sunk in type of a feeling, but as they were going up the cables, every time they saw lightning, they would yank their hands off the cables just in case.
Like, isn't that enough to be like, maybe we shouldn't be doing this?
It would be enough for
maybe
me.
Maybe this is a bad idea.
It would be enough for me.
Ay, ay, ay.
So as these two were kind of getting to the summit, Brian Jordan, who had mostly caught up with them, was reaching the base of the cables. Just behind him were Frith and Weiner, and they noticed the sign that was at the base of Subdome warning them of the risk of thunderstorms and lightning. And Weiner made a comment to Frith about this, and Frith dismissed his concerns and told him the exact same thing that Rice had told him, that there was a cave at the summit and they would be able to take shelter from the storm if it got too violent. At around 6 p.m., Rice and Esteban made it to the summit and ran towards the rock cave shelter to wait out the storm. Minutes later, Brian Jordan was standing on the summit looking around for where Rice and Esteban were, and then just a moment after that, Frith and Weiner also appeared. Rice being exactly the type of person that he sounds like, had removed all of his clothes, which were now soaked, and stepped out of the cave to greet the others to let them know where they were, and they all congregated inside of the shelter. This rock shelter, and I'm going to have to show you a picture of this because it doesn't make sense otherwise. So this rock shelter was part of an overhang on the summit, and for those listening, I'm also posting a picture of this on social media. So there's like two kind of openings in the side of this overhang. The upper opening is the opening for the cave. And then when like outside of that opening, there's like a couple of rocks that are like offset a little bit. I'm going to back up. The overhang looks like a whole bunch of large rocks that were stacked on top of each other. And it kind of looks like some of those rocks had like broken off on the sides and created an opening. Outside of that opening are these broken rocks. And just below that is a ledge called King's Chair. So I'll show you this picture real quick before we get too much farther. And in this picture, there's a person standing there. So the top opening is the cave that they were hiding in.
That little crevice?
Yes.
I mean, I wouldn't want to be in there at any point.
So that's where they went into. Right here is King's Chair.
Okay.
It's part of the story. So
and what? How much? How far up? How?
They're a mile high.
Is this like at the top?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So those broken rocks then lead down to the ledge called King's Chair. King's Chair actually has a little bit of a tilt back so that you can like kind of rest at back, and they say look up at the sky. I would not ever in my life put myself in a position to be down on King's Chair.
Yeah, there's, I mean,
no. So all of these five men were just really satisfied with what they accomplished, and they were sitting inside of the cave and were kind of getting into their packs and searching for dry clothes to help keep them warm. And as you can see, the cave is not very large. So they were like shoulder to shoulder, didn't really have a whole lot of elbow room. And they also started pulling out food to snack on and wait out the storm. And I thought it was really interesting that rice packed a head of broccoli. That was his snack, was a head of broccoli.
Okay.
So it was about 6:25 when Esteban noticed that the rain had slowed and convinced Frith to go out and make their way down to the ledge called King's Chair. And he and so Esteban and another friend had discovered King's Chair on a prior trip, and the ledge is about 4 feet wide and 30 inches deep.
Okay, not enough.
I agree.
Honestly, it looks bigger in the picture.
It does look bigger in the picture.
That's 30 inches.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the to get onto this section, you have to climb over a boulder that's about 2.5 feet tall. And again, the ledge tilted back slightly, so that way you kind of lean against the side of Half Dome, and it makes it a really convenient position to take a rest and look up at the sky. At this same time, Pippi and Bruce Jordan reached the cables at the bottom once again, and fat drops of rain began to fall from the sky, and the thunder was rolling around them. And this time, instead of climbing up the cables, they decided to set up their tent and wait for the storm to pass.
This is Poopy Pants?
This is Poopy Pants.
Okay.
Yes. So Hoag's group, as well as Brian Cage's group, were also setting up camp a little bit farther down the trail, and as they looked up at the summit, they could see figures climbing the cables, and they could see lightning light up the area, and from their location they saw lightning as it struck the summit, and then were able to follow the bolt as it traveled across the summit and was just like carried around by the water and rock. So Esteban and Frith were sitting in King's Chair when they heard the sound of bacon sizzling, and Esteban got up because he thought that the guys in the cave were cooking something, and so he's like, what the heck are you guys doing? He is climbing over the boulder with his left hand and left foot connected to the rock when a flash of light blinded the area. The earth-shattering boom that followed left each person experiencing something different. Most screamed out, but were either temporarily deaf or couldn't hear a sound, and others' ears were ringing so severely that they couldn't process what was happening. They had been struck by lightning. So this is the first real...
Okay.
Incident. Esteban, in particular, felt himself get thrown against the side of the ledge. His left hand was pinned to the rock, and he watched as his arm swelled, twisted, and then he felt like he imploded and was getting yanked from his own body. With a rare realization for what was happening, he shouted no and suddenly was back in his own body, but he still wasn't able to move at all. So it felt like it took a long time, especially with how he was like being able to like take in everything that he was seeing and like processing and like his arm and his feelings and all of these things. And really, it was just a millisecond that this occurred.
Your brain thin slices traumatic events.
Yeah.
So it feels like time slows.
Yeah.
I've experienced that. It's wild.
I've had probably like two experiences where it's like things just were happening so fast, but in my memory I'm like, I can give you every single little detail about this particular event. Yeah. So, and he's not the only one who had this particular experience with lightning, but he was probably one of the more vocal ones. Probably because even though he was struck, because he had his left hand, left foot connected, the lightning stayed on the left side of his body and it didn't cross over. And so he was still injured, but he wasn't as bad off as the other guys who we're going to come to.
So he describes his arm twisting. Is that just the sensation that he had, or was it was he physically being?
I think it was. I think it was the sensation.
Okay,
but I can't be certain. Knowing what I know, and what you will learn here in the second part, because this is definitely going to be two parts. He doesn't really have massive injuries. Okay. So I don't think...
It's just kind of his experience of what happened. Physical. Okay.
Yeah. Or maybe like his muscles felt like they were like being pulled from the bone, or... Sorry for that description if anybody's queasy about it. So the bolt of lightning had struck the cave, and because of the water and the rock conducting electricity, this bolt then shot down the rocks into the boulder that Esteban was climbing over, entered through one of his knuckles on his left hand, traveled up his arm, down his torso, and then out his left glute and left thigh.
Okay, so specific.
Yeah.
How do they know that?
Injuries, burns.
Really?
Yeah.
It's a burn. Oh, okay. Yeah.
So basically the two places that he was in contact with the rock was where it entered and exited his body.
Oof.
And again, as I've already mentioned, this was actually really good because it kept that line all on one side of his body. So then inside of the cave, Weiner was bent forward, adjusting his boots. So he was only touching the wall with where he was kind of connected with his legs and his butt. And he said that he also felt this same implosion feeling, but that he also felt like he was being pulled in a multitude of directions at the same time. And then he lost consciousness. When he came back to, he realized that he was screaming, but he couldn't hear himself and he was numb from the waist down. He originally thought that one of the camp stoves that they had been using exploded, but then as his senses came back to him, he realized that he could hear Esteban moaning next to him and muttering something along the lines of, "I'm dead, I must be dead."
Oh no.
And this is when Weiner looked around. He saw Brian Jordan next to him, and that's when he realized that they had been struck by lightning. Brian Jordan was sitting next to Weiner. They had been shoulder to shoulder, or they were physically touching. Weiner had been bent forward, adjusting his boots, so they must have been hip to hip. Brian Jordan had no facial expression. His chin had dropped to his chest, but he was otherwise in the same seated position. And he, on the other side of Brian Jordan, was a pack that had metal frames.
No.
So this pack had burn holes in it, roughly the size of basketballs. And because of the metal frames of the packs, the lightning traveled through one pack, went through the pack, entered Brian's right shoulder where he was touching the pack, and then shot out the left side of his chest. So first thing that Weiner does is he tries to convince Esteban that he is in fact alive and not dead. And then taking stock of the situation, he saw Rice, who had been sitting in the cave eating his head of broccoli, and he looked like he had been thrown against the wall next to him and then like slouched down. So he was kind of curled up in the fetal position on his side. He was having seizures and was twitching, and his body, you know, was just jerking uncontrollably, and his legs. I'm going to put a disclaimer that this is bad. The hairs on his legs had been singed, and it looked like his legs were like a burnt hot dog that cracked open. He had a glazed look in his eye, and it appears that maybe a rock or part of the cave had been destroyed when the lightning struck it, and Rice's left leg was twisted in an unusual way beneath the rock. He, because he was eating his broccoli, had vomited and was gagging on that broccoli. So Rice's legs were also so damaged that his wounds were cauterized, so he wasn't bleeding, and they had smoke coming out of them. And Esteban, who was now kind of recovering a bit at this point, realized that Frith was still sitting on King's chair, and even though his legs were hurting and he was partially paralyzed from the pain, he army crawled his way over to look to see how Frith was doing. When he got there, he saw that Frith, also similar to Rice, having what looked like seizures, and he was slightly contorting in his movements. He had vomited, and it looked like there was froth still coming out of his mouth. His eyes had rolled back into his head, and his forehead had an inch-long slice in it. And there is really no easy way to describe what happens next. So Esteban kind of crawls over the rocks to try to get down to Frith and like pull him back up onto the ledge, because he's like scooting himself essentially off of it.
Yeah.
So Esteban gets down there, and as he gets closer, he says that it looks as if somebody had stabbed him in the forehead with a white hot dagger, because the gash was open, but it had also been cauterized.
Yeah.
It can be concluded that the bolt entered Frith's body from where he was seated and went up his torso, out his forehead.
Oh my gosh.
Frith was thrashing so hard that Esteban was scared that he was just going to throw himself off the ledge. So he got himself down to the boulder and leaned his upper body over the boulder, grabbed a hold of Frith's pants, and was able to kind of like hand grab his way up to Frith's arm. But he didn't have enough leverage or strength to pull Frith back up to the safety of the summit, so he started yelling for help. Weiner, being the only person who could respond at this point in time, also worked his way over to kind of figure out what was going on and why Esteban was calling for help. And he looked over the ledge to see Esteban was clinging to Frith, who was precariously perched on the very edge of the small ledge. Weiner was able to grab a hold of Frith's sweater and then work his way over to Frith's left arm. And from here, they each had a hold on to one of his arms. So they started trying to pull, but like Esteban, Weiner has no use of his legs. So he grabs a hold of Frith's hand and starts begging him to squeeze his hand or do anything to show him that he was still alive. And at the same time, another buzzing sound started in the air. Esteban freaks out, and there's later a huge struggle that goes on about this. Esteban freaks out, lets go of Frith's arm, and army crawls away. So Weiner was less willing to let go of his friend, who he brought with him on this trip, and just kept a vice-like grip onto his arm for as long as he could. But as Frith continued to seize and his convulsions had worked him off of the ledge, Weiner was starting to get pulled down with him.
So Frith is hanging off of King's chair.
Yes.
Okay.
When he got too far over the edge, Weiner began to feel himself being pulled over the rocks and towards the ledge himself. And in the end, Weiner had no other option but to let his friend go. And he watched as his friend plummeted to the rocks.
Oh my gosh.
That were 2,200 feet below. Weiner, in shock and despair, returned to the cave. And I do want to put a little asterisk in here that I think the only kind of like, nothing makes it better, but Frith was likely dead.
Or was not going to survive.
There was too much done. And he was too far gone. And like I said, nothing makes it better. I mean, watching someone you care for fall off a cliff is not a... I personally don't think it's something that you can recover from. You just learn to cope with.
Yeah.
But that's like the only little bit of like a little bit of a breath. Like...
Yeah, exiting the forehead's not a good sign.
No.
Because, like, what kind of brain damage did he...
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. That's so horrific.
Yeah. So, in his retreat, Esteban went past Rice and, momentarily forgetting what was going on, saw that he was choking on the broccoli and cleared his mouth out and then started trying to shake him and like, get him to come back. And unfortunately, the crackling sound started up again, and this caused him to panic. And he crawled out of the cave and crossed the summit to where there was a depression in the summit, which was the area that people used as the bathroom.
Okay.
So he crawls to this area, and just as he gets here, he feels the summit vibrate and he gets a shock of a second lightning strike. The second strike this time, though, he said he felt that it was more of like just like a jolt that entered his body rather than like voltage, and that it was nothing in comparison to the first bolt. Weiner, however, was resting with his full back against the wall of the cave when the second bolt struck, and it hit again this cave. And this time he was electrocuted so strongly that he had an out-of-body experience. He says that he pulled away from his body and watched as his physical self shuddered before collapsing to the ground and on top of Rice's leg. But once his body was at rest, he was able to easily move back into it. But as he did, he became acutely aware of throbbing pain that was emerging from his chest. And his left boot has been thrown from his body at this point. And every time he moved his legs or his chest, even from breathing, it hurt so bad that for a moment he considered how difficult it would be for him to get down onto King's chair so that way he could throw himself to his death.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's such a wild thought process. In that moment, to then jump to suicide.
Yeah. And it might, I personally think it might have been a combination of like, wow, I just watched my friend die because I couldn't hold on to him anymore. And you're already in this really low place from that.
Yeah.
And then you come to and you're in a severe amount of pain and you just are...
just like despair.
Yeah.
Wow. That's so interesting. I mean, in a terrible way, but that's like not what I would have never guessed that was what he would be thinking.
Yeah. So that's where we're going to leave it for this one.
Holy crap.
Thank you for listening. please take a moment to rate and subscribe from wherever you listen to Tragedy with a View. To get access to ad-free episodes, bonus content, and more, please join us on our Patreon. The link will be in the show notes. Don't forget to follow us on Instagram and Facebook, and to share a story of your own, send us a Campfire Confessional email at tragedywithaview@gmail.com. We'll see you next time.